In the past year, artificial intelligence has captured our imagination like never before and like nothing else. It's transformed everything from how we work to how we perceive the world around us to increasingly who we are as people. And with this technological renaissance, there are very few names that stand out as prominently as Mustafa Suleiman. He has a career that's deeply rooted in AI. He's been at the forefront of this field for well over a decade, co-founding DeepMind and playing a critical role in its mission to solve intelligence and to use it to make the world a better place. And today, we're sitting down with Mustafa to discuss both the exciting potential of AI as well as concerns about the future of AI. Mustafa, thank you for joining us. Mustafa, you've been working on artificial intelligence for, you know, like almost 20 years now, right? So what's happened that has made this such an omnipresent thing in all of our lives?
Well, for much of that time, like you said, I've been among a small group of very fringe AI researchers who mostly been considered to be a little bit crazy. You know, back in 2010, when I first started DeepMind, you know, most people who heard that I was working on AI thought that I was really, you know, nothing to do with mainstream culture, a weirdo futurist, and, you know, working on something that was very speculative. So for as long as I can remember, we've kind of been an outsider. And in the last sort of few years, I would say, it's kind of grown in the popular imagination. I think a lot of that started several years back with AlphaGo, which was an AI that we designed to play the ancient Chinese board game of Go, which is played on a 19 by 19 square grid.
It's a lot more complicated than chess, absolutely.
Yeah, it was kind of the next big frontier for AI after IBM beat the game of chess with Deep Blue back in 1997. And obviously, as everyone knows, that's on an 8x8 grid, and the pieces can only move in very fixed ways. Whereas on a 19x19 grid, it's not only is it that much larger, but all the pieces are equal. There's just black and white stones, and you can place them anywhere on the grid. So the number of possible moves that can happen in the board game are just exponentially larger, something like 10 to the power of 170 possible configurations of the board. That is more atoms than there are in the known universe. So it's a 10 with 170 zeros next to it, after it. It's just an incredibly insane possible number of configurations. So all the traditional methods of rule-based search, where you would say, if there are some pieces in this area, then, you know, don't place them there, but place them adjacent, which is traditionally how people trained AIs to play chess. Those methods didn't work because the size of the space was just so huge. So we had to invent these learning methods. And over the years, we've applied those learning methods to other domains. We started off with games, then moved into image recognition, then moved into audio transcription. So you can sort of write down the words that I say phonetically. And then in the last couple of years, you know, coming back to your question of why things have gone crazy in the last year or so, is because we've actually been able to apply a similar suite of methods, deep learning, to generate new text that is unique, right? And that's the kind of incredible thing that has happened here. We've gone from classification, so understanding the content of images, understanding that two languages translate in the following way, understanding the content of a piece of text or a paragraph, to then being able to generate a new example of that paragraph or a new image or some new speech or music at human level performance. You know, a lot of these AIs now are pretty much as good as most humans at being creative or, you know, answering questions.
So nowadays we can have a conversation with an AI bot, and I mean, we can't really tell the difference between it and another human being. That's a fair point, right?
Yeah, I mean, that is one of the surreal moments that we live in, right? When you talk to one of these AIs, like ChatGPT, or my own company, Inflection, for example, makes an AI called Pi, P-I, which stands for personal intelligence. When you talk to Pi, I mean, it's just like chatting to a regular human. You can actually phone Pi, and it will speak to you in a very fluent, smooth conversational voice. It has empathy, it has emotional intelligence, and yeah, in many respects, it's just like talking to a human. And so many people would say that we have nearly passed the famous Turing test, which was proposed, you know, back in the 1950s by this great computer scientist and mathematician called Alan Turing, who said that if you could, you know, design a computer to speak to another human and it would be impossible to tell whether it was actually a computer or a human speaking, then we could say that that AI or that computer system was intelligent and it had passed the Turing test. And now we're pretty much at that moment. I think, you know, it's still possible to tell if you really pay attention or if the conversation goes on long enough. But if it's only just, you know, two or three or five turns of conversation, it's very difficult to tell. And that's an amazing moment.
It's not that the AI is intelligent. It's just that we perceive it to be intelligent. In reality, it's just taking all of this data and pattern recognition and it's predicting things on the basis of the prompt that we write in, right? I mean, it's a program at the end of the day. It's not thinking.
Well, it's interesting because with every new technology, we're forced to reconsider our basic assumptions. So we thought we had a good grasp of what intelligence is because it was compared to passing the Turing test. Whereas now we've passed the Turing test, people are like, well, maybe it's not that intelligent after all, right? So maybe it wasn't a very good test. And that is the process of science, is that we posit a hypothesis, we develop some, you know, experiments to test that hypothesis, and then we review the evidence and we generate a new test. And so today we have to generate a new test because it's pretty clear that these things are not really intelligent, even though they're very capable. So I've proposed a new test, the modern Turing test, which actually evaluates what an AI can do, not just what it can say. So I think a better measure of an AI is an artificial capable intelligence, an ACI. So what can this thing do in the labor market? What jobs can it do? Can it write emails? Can it negotiate contracts? Can it invent new products? Can it, you know, market and promote a product and persuade people to buy it? And if it can do all of those things, and, you know, do it in a way that enables it to make a profit on a product, that's kind of like a mini entrepreneur. It's like a little startup person. And I think that over the next sort of 3 or 4 years, there will be AIs that can do all those things I've described and actually turn a real profit from a new product. And that'll be a watershed moment because that's many of the skills that a lot of people use in their day-to-day jobs.
So I want to get to the future, but let's start with the present just for a moment. I mean, for young people today that are hearing about artificial intelligence, as so many of us are for the first time, what should they, if they're curious, what should they be doing with artificial intelligence? How should a person start engaging in a way that will be constructive and useful for their future?
Well, the first thing to say is that these AIs have all of the knowledge that has been put on the open internet. So they're actually extremely smart. Not only have they been trained on Wikipedia many, many times over, but they've read millions of blog posts, millions of news articles, many books in many cases that are available on the open web. And so they're very knowledgeable. So the first thing to do is just talk to one. Pick a topic that you are really interested in, maybe one that you know something about, and try to test the limits of the AI's knowledge by probing it and questioning it and going back and forth. I'm sure many people have already tried them out. And I think, you know, give Pi a go. It's really an incredible experience. And once you play around with it a little bit, you realize A, the magic and how impressive it is, but B, where it kind of trips up. Sometimes it goes in circles, sometimes it doesn't remember things correctly. And that gives you an intuition for where the cutting edge is today, where it's weak and where it's strong. And then I would say, if you're really interested, is try and prompt one of these AIs. Try and give it a stylistic guide, you know, try and get it to, you know, talk in the style of, you know, President Obama or, you know, one of your favorite celebrities or Shakespeare, sure. You know, and invent something with it, you know, treat it as an aid, a creative brainstorming partner. And then you can see again what the shape of it is. And if you want to go even further, you know, many of these models are available in open source software, and you can have a go at trying to program one of them.
And what's something that you could program an AI today to do that would be interesting?
I mean, you could program it, for example, to be a, you know, expert in Formula One racing and talk to you in the style of Shakespeare, if you like. Anything, you know, it can embody the character and persona of anything that you can imagine and take advantage of the depth of knowledge that it has been trained on. So it might be an expert in talking about cactuses. It might know everything about Harley Davidsons. It might know all about the dinosaurs. Anything that you can think of, it is going to be able to imitate that knowledge in a particular style. And so the world is your oyster. You can create game characters. You know, you can create, you know, little aides or assistants or friends, you know, to play with or to talk to. Fiction that you can co-write together. You know, you write part of the story. The AI writes the other part of the story. So, you know, it's really limitless what can be done with these things.
And you and I are great optimists on how much AI is doing and where this technology is going. But we're also very well aware that with all of these opportunities to program AI to do incredible things, if you want to program it to do bad things, you probably can. And I mean, you can use it to learn and promote information, but you can use it to promote disinformation and to fake people and to get people to believe things that aren't true. What do we need to do to limit the potential for AI to be used in ways that are dangerous for our society?
Well, one of the things is that at the moment, many of the AI services are available through large established providers. And those providers have all committed to responsible and ethical principles. And it's incumbent on all of us to hold those providers to account based on what they've said. So about not spreading misinformation, not spreading factually untrue content, and, you know, crucially, I think, not imitating a known public figure, right? Because what we don't want is to have a bunch of AIs that, you know, where in the future it will be impossible to tell whether, you know, a celebrity or a politician or a business person, you know, had in fact given a message or said something, made a recording, issued a statement. But in fact, it was actually a deep fake. It was a made up piece of content. And at the moment, most of the big providers of these AIs are very responsible and take lots of efforts to prevent those kinds of things. I think in the future, these models are going to be increasingly available in open source. And so that's going to get harder to, you know, sort of contain and to moderate.
And when you say in open source, you mean like you're not going to just get it from Meta or Google or Microsoft or Inflection, that you could get it just like on the open web. And then the rules are whatever the rules happen to be for that provider.
Yeah. And I think that's going to become more and more a challenge of the open internet is, you know, where are the boundaries of that and how does it get restricted? Because, you know, you're going to be able to take this software and run your own AI independent of any big provider in 5 years' time, right? I mean, today you can run them, you know, in the open source and they're pretty good. But in the future, they're going to be really, really good. So we just have to think about the right way to make sure that we have stable and peaceful outcomes and that the transition to this new AI future doesn't happen too quickly and isn't too chaotic. Because as we've seen in the past, sometimes there can be unintended consequences.
Now, we aren't yet at the point that we would use an AI to be our lawyer. We might use it to help our lawyer, but we wouldn't use it to be it, or to be our teacher, or to be our nurse. But it sounds like in very short periods of time, you believe that AI is going to be able to replace a lot of these functions. Take us a little bit along that path. Not all the way yet, but just like the next year or two. Because, I mean, we keep seeing all of these new announcements and, you know, you said, well, AI can generate text and it can sound like a human being. Yeah, but you can have a conversation with it. Well, now we see AI can generate images and there are images that are more impressive than almost any artist or graphic design. Then now we see just recently AI can generate video and can generate a movie that, I mean, you know, you would see in Hollywood maybe or really close. What's coming next? What do we see in the next year or two that's going to blow our minds that we're going to start using everywhere?
I think that the reality is that over the next 2 to 3 years, we are going to be surrounded by a new species of digital people. And, you know, we have wrestled with different metaphors for describing this new technology era for many decades, and none of them seem to be sufficient or up to the task. You know, some people have compared AI to another general purpose technology like electricity. General purpose because it's like a raw commodity that enables many, many other technologies and products and services to be built on top of it. I mean, who could think of living in the modern world today without electricity? You know, going back even further, the printing press was an earlier general purpose technology because it enabled anybody to broadcast their ideas and organize and plan and so on. So many meta capabilities arose because of that platform.
Or the internet, same thing.
Or indeed the internet. That's another good example of a general purpose technology. But today, it's hard to say that AI is a general purpose technology. I mean, it certainly is, but that's not all it is. It is interactive. It produces new and dynamically emergent content in a personalized way, uniquely to you at every moment. That is very different to the very predictable nature of electricity, for example, right? The actual infrastructure of the internet was very stable and predictable. We know exactly how many packets can be sent across a certain wire of a certain speed at a certain time. Whereas here, this is like a completely new design material, right? That no two answers to the same question will be the same, right? Every interaction is very different. And now that these interactions are becoming completely dynamic, right? What, you know, you say something, the AI says something, you say something. It's actually much more like talking to a full digital person. So in 2 or 3 years' time, there will be an avatar that will be a human-like or other kind of character representation that is very animated and just like you or I speaking to one another now. As you say, it will be able to generate video in real time completely seamlessly on your phone, on your desktop, on your tablet, in your car, right? And so rather than browsing a web page, right? Today, when you go to look for information, you type a query into Google and you get a static web page that was probably made 2 years ago, or maybe even some cases 5 years ago. And that's like a billboard, right? It's a static representation that doesn't change. It certainly doesn't change to adapt to you or me, right? It's just, we both see the same thing. You type in a website, we both see exactly the same thing, regardless of the time of day or the location or back history or what we're interested in. In the future, content is going to be served to every individual in a completely personalized and interactive way. So your web page of images and text and video is going to unfurl itself on the fly, completely novel, adapted to your interests and what you've talked about previously with your AI. And that's just a completely different paradigm that I think, you know, people are sort of not quite yet grasping.
Mustafa, when you say digital people, what do you mean by that?
Well, if you think about it, what makes a person is my ability to speak to you right now, my ability to see what you see, and my ability to take actions. So, you know, buy things, book things, plan, arrange, coordinate, write emails, make phone calls. At some point in the next few years, an AI is going to be able to do all of those things pretty much as well as a human. But of course, it won't be a human. It will be a digital person. And I think that's probably the best metaphor to help us understand what's coming over the next few years.
What does it mean as we move into an environment where so many of the interactions that we will have will be with digital people as opposed to people? How do you think that changes the economy? How does it change society? How does it change government? What are some of your thoughts about that?
Well, one of the amazing things about these digital people is that they can actually be made to be very controlled, right? You can actually design very precise behaviors And so, for example, in the AI that we've made, Pi, it is very kind and empathetic. It's very supportive. It's very encouraging. It's infinitely patient. It doesn't judge you, right? And so many of the downsides of human interaction, where you might feel socially anxious, you might feel a bit paranoid about what the other person's thinking, you might feel pushed around, right? Or you might feel that that other person didn't hear you out. You know, you were telling a story about your ski trip and suddenly they're talking about their ski trip that they had last year. And you're like, wait, but I haven't finished my thought. And your AI doesn't do that to you. Your AI is infinitely patient and supportive. And so there's a huge amount of upside there. But it's also a big transition, right? Because I think increasingly people will choose to spend time with their AIs, perhaps more than they spend time with other humans. And so one of the design considerations that we have to factor in and we think about a lot at Inflection is to really pay attention to the values of the AI and how we condition and shape the AI, for example, to encourage you to spend more time with your loved ones, to encourage you to be brave and overcome your social anxiety and go to the party, to provide you with a safe space to practice for your interview or your exam, but still have you focused on being out in the real world, connected, having experiences with other humans. And so every single discipline, every single area of society is going to have to grapple with this new reality that there will in fact be digital people that are as, you know, significant and as important as, you know, every other, you know, sort of relationship in our lives. I mean, it would be impossible to consider today not having a smartphone in your life, right? Or a laptop, that's just become second nature in less than a decade.
Yes.
You know, 6 billion people have a smartphone now or more, right? And so that's probably the trajectory we're on for these personal intelligences. I mean, this is the natural evolution of technology from personal computing to personal intelligence.
And I think people will be relieved to hear you say that you find it important that the values of these AI people that you are developing, that you're inventing, needs to be humane and needs to keep people engaging with other people. Of course, you and I can both imagine that there are going to be lots of corporations that want to maximize profitability and therefore ensure that people are engaging with their AI as much as humanly possible, just as some companies do with their smartphones or their applications, just as sometimes you want to sell as much food as you possibly can to a person, so even if it means that they're obese, all of these things. And I wonder, I mean, do you think that how do we guard against the excesses that comes from a technology that is changing so much faster than our ability to understand it, train with it, prepare for it? I mean, you know, we're going to be mostly the people we are right now, and these things are suddenly just going to be poof around us, right? It's not like we can train people to like, okay, this is like you've got to grow into becoming an adult and here's what it is. You know, it's just going to be there.
Well, look, I think that, you know, we are making incredible progress as a civilization, including on the corporation front, right? And society is changing much faster than I think people fully realize. If you roll back to the 50s and the kinds of companies that we had and the kind of, you know, way that they would externalize their downsides, whether it was dumping chemicals into the river, you know, or, you know, really mistreating their staff in horrible ways. You know, I think that it's inconceivable that we would have companies that are really pushing smoking in the way that they did back in the day, or really pushing, you know, obesity and fatty foods. Like we're really, I think, making a march forward. And look, it's not a solved problem. You know, fundamentally, companies are constantly in a battle to try to be more responsible and to be more considerate and respectful of their people. All I can say is that for my part at Inflection, we've tried to structure the company in a way that we proactively think about those consequences, and we're actually registered legally as a public benefit corporation.
Okay, so but now let's go maybe 5 years in the future, not 10, not 20, just five, where we are already starting to see AI that is able to do a lot of the jobs that people have today, that young people are thinking about having in the future. How should someone considering their career adapt to a future of AI that is so explosive, so transformative, and so near term? So much uncertainty about what society will look like, more than ever in the history of human beings. How do young people think differently about preparing themselves for the future?
Well, the cool thing about it is that more so than ever before, these technologies are accessible and programmable by people who don't have technical skills. So you don't have to be a professional engineer to be able to play with an AI model. You can prompt it using your own language with your own ideas. And that means that you can bring all your creativity and, you know, all of your inventiveness to an off-the-shelf AI model very, very easily. So that's the first thing I would say is, you know, don't be afraid because people think that there's a big technical barrier to get over. That's not true anymore. Secondly, there's clearly a huge benefit to people who come from outside of software engineering and technical fields actually playing with these things. So we need more, you know, wide-ranging voices, people with different backgrounds, you know, grabbing hold of this stuff and making new things with it, because all perspectives are needed at this time. This is a massive transition, just like the arrival of the internet or the arrival of light. I mean, can you imagine what it was like for the people who first saw a light bulb turn on and saw the power of electricity? That sparked a revolution in people inventing things in microelectronics and, you know, in myriad ways to make our lives more comfortable. So think of this as a creative and exciting moment to, you know, be an inventor and to use these tools to, you know, basically make our dreams come true. This is a great moment.
Well, let me ask, all of these transformations also create disruptions. Some of those disruptions are super opportunities. Some of them are more challenging if you're not ready. Give us a couple of jobs that you think people shouldn't actually want to get into in the next 5 or 10 years because they're not going to be around with AI. And why?
Well, you know, any new technology disrupts certain jobs, right? So it's pretty clear that call center operators, for example, who manage customer service requests, or even, you know, who do sales, for example, you know, there are going to be AIs that try to do that more efficiently. And we're already seeing those kinds of things. So I'd be worried about those kinds of jobs. I think that the most valuable skill sets are going to be those that straddle creative skills, as well as problem solving and technical. You know, so breadth is more important than ever. That's one of the things that AIs don't do so well, is integrate a wide range of different skills, you know, into a single source. So I would say be bold and do multidisciplinary, you know, educational courses that teach you the best of both.
So Mustafa, this is a technology that will improve human capabilities to anyone that has them. It'll lead to faster inventions, reduced waste, more efficiency in every field. As you say, it's more than just a transformative technology. It also changes how we think about the entire world and society. I'm wondering, for young people today who might think about having 50, 60, 70 more years on the planet, how do you think about their future? Will they even be recognizable as human beings when they're adults? Do you think they'll have limitless lifespan? I mean, in terms of when I think about applying artificial intelligence to medicine and to biotechnology and genetics, it really does seem staggering how much the world could change from what we can even imagine today.
I mean, I think that's true. Technology and the scientific process of invention is there to reduce our suffering. It's there to make our lives more peaceful and more enjoyable, right? You know, so just a few hundred years ago, the average life expectancy was closer to 50 years old, right? So we have, science has massively advanced our well-being and health because we've invented drugs and we've found ways to, you know, get more crops, for example, out of the same square hectare, right? I think that is an incredible achievement of creativity and invention. And we're about to take that engine of creativity, which was our human intelligence, and turn that into a, you know, commodity. We're going to make it widely available to millions of people to be able to be creative and inventive. So I think you're totally right. By 2050, I wouldn't be surprised if there were people who are being born that might live for 200 to 300 years, as we are going to make very fundamental breakthroughs in medical science that tackle aging, right? That cure disease. And so that raises the question, well, what do we do with our lives? Like, how do we live? If a large chunk of people are not working for their income for most of the day, then how do we find meaning and purpose? And people often ask me this question, and I actually think, well, remember when you were young and, you know, you had hobbies and passions and ambitions and desires and you were obsessed with things. That creativity and playfulness is increasingly going to be available to adults and people of all ages, because I think in the long-term future, the real challenge for us is figuring out how we support people when they don't work and maybe give them a universal basic income so that for at least a portion of their week, they're freed up from the everyday grind of work to take care of their families, to look after the elderly, to be more involved in bringing up children, to support community service, to be creative, you know. And I think that's kind of an important thing to remember. We didn't create society in order to artificially invent jobs and work for the sake of it. We work so that we can play, right? And so the goal is to reduce the amount of work that we are forced to do and increase the amount of time that we have for play and for chosen work. You may choose to still work super hard. That could be a choice. And it could be very productive, could be very creative and inventive. But I think that's a much better society that we want to live in, where most people, most of the time, are choosing how to spend most of their week.
Yeah, and it feels like the pandemic has in some ways helped us think about that transition, right? You already have people who say, you know what, I don't want to be in the office from 9 to 5 every day with a 1-hour commute both ways. I actually want to spend more time with my family, spend more time with my friends, with my pets, engage more, live in a place that I'm happy living. It turns out that the pandemic and the technology that came from, you know, sort of distance engagement, Zoom calls, all the rest, technology facilitated more independence of choice for people all over the world to live the way they want to live and balance their lives with what they do for a living. And artificial intelligence just turbocharges that. Is that the way you're thinking about this?
Yeah, I think that we got a good taster of prioritization during the pandemic. And in fact, that's actually a really interesting point, because it shows you how, you know, many unquestioned assumptions are actually buried underneath the structure of society. Who would have thought that we could actually work entirely remote and be pretty productive, right? And, you know, there, it's not that it was without consequences, but the world carried on, right? And there are actually huge benefits now to working, you know, part-time and not being 5 days in the office. Huge, huge benefits. So, you know, I think that who would have thought that actually that was something that we could re-engineer in terms of society? So I'm very interested in this question. Like, what are the other things that we take for granted today? What are the silly rules? What are the silly social habits and customs and practices and structures that just are because they were, that we could re-engineer and turn upside down and make them more, you know, favorable to every single one of us as individuals?
And it turned out we could re-engineer it immediately, because we had to, because the pandemic forced it. It didn't take years. It took weeks. It took weeks, and people showed they could actually work completely differently. You know, I can think of a few things that could be re-engineered by a society that didn't have to work for wealth. You know, gender bias, right? Racism, nationalism. I mean, a world where people can actually live the way they want to, and not just a few people, but anyone that has access to these technologies, will be a world where people choose not to be discriminated against to a much greater degree, right? Because they don't have to play those power games that society forces upon them, because that's the way it's been done for generations and generations.
Yeah, and I agree. And I think one of the other things that is coming down the line that is going to change that is the ability to generate power, electricity, in a decentralized way. If we really do get a battery breakthrough in the next 20 years, such that renewables, you know, I guess primarily solar, but also wind, can be generated very far away from cities and stored and can carry you through, that's going to completely change the way that cities operate. And it's going to change how much emphasis we put on living close to one another or in existing, existing cities and urban areas. So there's lots of those technological breakthroughs which I think are cooking away in the background, which will completely change the social structure that we are currently so used to.
Mustafa Suleiman, thanks so much for joining me. And for our viewers, if you're intrigued by the possibilities of AI and you want to dive deeper into this fascinating world, we invite you to check out our other videos in this series. And thank you for watching.